It depends upon the nature of the trouble we are working on. It was fascinating to watch him maneuver and manipulate the light wherever he wished it to fall. Now here is another kind of ray. Watch. The blue beam ceased, and in its place a bright red one descended. This, he explained, is a stimulating light. It provides energy, it builds up not only an affected part after treatment, but the whole body, and that is greatly needed on Earth at this moment. Our friends of Earth need not fear that we shall run short. There was a distinct feeling of warmth with the red ray, and Roger remarked upon it. That is so, my son. Usually some warmth is needed with the application of the red ray, but we have special heat rays, where we work with heat alone. The colors of these rays are more for distinguishing purposes, though the color does help. But the force is really in the ray itself rather than in the color. Well, now, I think you've seen everything, except a demonstration of our work, and that, I'm afraid, we can't show you here. But I must introduce you to my family. Come along into the garden. Our host opened a door that led directly into the garden, and we stepped out of doors. Turning to our left, we found ourselves in a most exquisite garden. It was very broad and with two long walls upon either side. Our friend explained that these were not to establish his territorial rights, but merely to hide from first sight the grounds that were upon the other sides. In addition, they formed a perfect background to the tall plants and flowering shrubs that were growing immediately in front of them. Equally spaced throughout the length of the walls were fairly wide openings beneath rounded arches, the whole of which produced a most pleasing antique effect. There were many grand trees flourishing in the full vigor of their heavenly growth, free from the winds that deform so many trees on earth, and here displaying their true form in unblemished nature. In the center of this haven, there was a lily pond sunk below the level of the ground, with wide steps leading down to a paved surround. We could see no evidence of the family, but in response to a call from our friend, there came bounding across the large tract of grass upon which we were standing, two beautiful creatures, one a large dog, and the other a puma. I have omitted to mention that as we emerged from the laboratory, the small bird that Roger had retained in his hand, then flew away in a direct line to a huge tree. He now emerged bringing with him, as it were, a raven and a macaw. Radiant Wing held out his arms, and the two birds at once perched upon them. The small bird flew back to Roger. "What do you think of my family?" Radiant Wing asked. "The dog, the raven, and the macaw are my own. The small bird you have there, my son, belongs to friends who are still on Earth, and this lovely puma, as well, belongs to one of them, who is also my instrument on Earth." The colors of the macaw contrasted vividly with the blackness of the raven and the soft gray of the sparrow. Roger was obviously a trifle timid of the puma, no doubt from his recollection of the same kind of animal on Earth, but our host at once reassured him. "You need have no fear, my son," said he. "See, she is without her wildness, and wishes harm to no one." Ruth had stooped down and was stroking and playing with the lovely creature, which was as gentle as a lamb. "She is not the only one of her kind here, by any means," continued our host, "but their dispositions are all the same harmless and gentle. You see, the two chief earthly factors are gone from all the animals in these lands: the need for food, which makes them prey upon others, and fear of both their own and of humankind. Remove these two, and there you have the result. They are a great joy to us and to themselves. Try for yourself, my son." Roger bent down beside Ruth, and in a moment had lost his misgivings in stroking the puma's thick fur. "She is the mad one," said Radiant Wing, "and continually keeps all the others on the stretch. Watch her now with the little bird." Roger held up his hand and the sparrow flew into the air only a short distance above the ground, but high enough to be provokingly out of reach of the puma. At this height he flew in a somewhat erratic manner, hither and thither, without appearing to be upon any direct course. The puma immediately gave chase, and as the bird followed a zigzag way, so his companion on the ground tried to emulate him. The acrobatics she was obliged to perform sent us all into roars of laughter, while we could but admire the nimbleness of the agile creature on the ground. The latter made the most astonishing leaps into the air, evidently sure of catching her small friend on the wing, but she was foiled upon every occasion by the bird moving an inch or two higher, or to right or left. What would happen, asked Roger, if the puma actually caught up with the bird?
Why, nothing, answered Radiant Wing with a laugh. It would be impossible, even if they were not the very best of friends, which, of course, they are. There are no enemies here.
The game was quickly ended, however, by the bird swooping down upon the puma, and alighting upon the latter's head, who trotted back to us, and rolled herself over on the grass in evident satisfaction with her performance. Radiant Wing again turned to Roger. Now you know where I live, my son. I hope you will visit us whenever you wish. My boys and I will always be delighted to see you. Or, if you wish, just walk into the garden and enjoy yourself with my family. You may not always find all of them here, sometimes these two, he slightly raised his arms with the two large birds upon them, and the dog go with me when I'm on my earth missions. But you know the small bird, and friend Puma is most times hereabouts, and ready to play. Roger was delighted with this invitation, and thanked our friend warmly, as did Ruth and I, for spending so much time upon us and our new charge. 5. Spirit intercourse. As we strolled along after leaving Radiant Wing, it was easy to see that Roger was fairly deep in thought, no doubt pondering what he had seen both in the house and in the garden of our friend. At length he spoke. What astonishes me, is that all this is unknown to the world. How all this can be going on without somebody knowing about it, is more than I can understand. By the world, you mean the Earth, Roger. No, all this is not entirely unknown to the Earth people. Some of them are aware of it, but by comparison with the Earth's millions, only a very few. And how do they know? Because they have been told, friend Roger. We have told them. I don't mean Ruth and I, though we have done our microscopic share in the work. But the telling has been going on for years. The Earth has never been left high and dry, without someone to tell them about all this. Latterly, the flow of revelation has increased, but you must remember that one of the greatest ecclesiastical establishments on Earth has long ago decreed that all revelation ceased when the last of the apostles passed from the Earth. Since then, silence. Do you think that sounds at all likely from what you have seen, so far, of the way things are done here? No, I do not. Yet, that is the fact. Others believe that to know, or even try to know, anything about the afterlife is against Holy Writ. So there is another dead end. We are not meant to know. If we were, we should have been told. That's what those folks say. Yet they have been told officially, and in the very book that they say is against this knowledge. Strange, isn't it? Those people read that book piously, perhaps too piously, and fail to perceive that it is crammed, literally crammed with psychic lore of every kind. They will swallow whole accounts of it, but because those phenomena still happen, now, they will have nothing to do with them. If it was right in those far-off days and it was then, it must be right now, which it is. Officially, of course, there is silence. Wouldn't you think it to be in the interests of any religion to know? Or at least to try to find out.
Yes, Roger, that's what you would think. The position on Earth is roughly this. Of the two principal churches, one says decisively, dogmatically, that anyone is a fool who denies the existence of psychic phenomena of all kinds, but with equal insistence says that the cause of them is none other than the devil himself, or some of his satellites. That is what Omar meant when he said that there are nice people on Earth who would call him and all the rest of us just plain devils. Isn't the whole notion too utterly preposterous for words?
It is, but can't something be done about it? Ruth and I smiled at the healthy, vigorous enthusiasm of our young friend.
Roger, dear, said Ruth, your feelings do you great credit. We both know exactly how you feel. Monsignor and I had the same experience. We should have liked to have taken people's silly heads and banged them together, and tried to knock some sense into them, but we were restrained by wiser minds than ours. Now, I said, let me tell you what happened with the other important church I mentioned. That church held its inquiry into the whole subject of communication with the earth, ordered by no less a functionary than the archbishop himself. They investigated very thoroughly and deliberate very carefully, and compiled a report of their findings. The majority were in favor, and declared that communication did in fact exist.
Splendid. Now, Roger, if you are fond of a joke, we know you are. Get ready to laugh loudly.
The whole report was officially suppressed. Peculiar, isn't it, how people do not want to know about us and the life we are living here?
Of course there are very naughty people who say that if that report had been against, it would have been published with a flourish of trumpets to help it on.
I haven't told you the actual sequel yet. The Archbishop who ordered the inquiry and then ordered the report to be suppressed, has since come to live here himself.
It's a difficult job, my Roger, to try to undo some things we wish we had never done.
That good prelate has all my sympathy, for I too left behind me things which I had rather left undone. By great good fortune I have been enabled to put them right, not entirely right, you must understand, but sufficiently so to make very little difference. And where I spoke with vigor when I was on earth, I have since spoken with extra double strength vigor to make up for it. I can feel now in my mind a great calm and contentment that were lacking before. When we get home I will show you a volume that was the cause of the earthly trouble many years ago. It was terrible stuff.
Ruth laughed.
Don't get overheated, my dear, she said, there are much worse things on earth than that old book and more foolish. Both those churches take a peculiar interest in this world, a religious interest, of course. Neither knows what precisely to expect in the way of an afterlife. An afterlife there must be, naturally, but they can suggest nothing that does not imply some description of an essentially religious life. In effect, it means that the earth life is the real material life, and that the afterlife is conducted upon holy lines of some sort. Certainly the whole atmosphere will be pious, and totally unlike what man has been accustomed to on earth. They are right in the latter, this life is totally unlike the earth life, but not in the way they mean.
What's to be the end of it all, then? Will the churches eventually find the truth?
That is a large question. As they are at present constituted, nothing could be done. They are perfectly contented as they are. The first of the two I mentioned claims to be the one true church, and infallible. There would not seem to be much hope there. The second church possesses no authority whatever. Within broad limits, very broad ones, its members can think and believe what they like. The bishops have little or no authority over their clergy in matters of faith. There are some ministers who wholeheartedly support the spirit world as it really is, because they have spiritual knowledge derived directly from us. Even if this particular church pronounced in our favor officially, it by no means follows that the clergy and the laity would do the same thing. There are some who have this knowledge, and uphold the church as well with all its strange doctrines, in that they are trying to face both ways at once. But when they come here, they must eventually face only one way. You can see, Roger, what difficulties are in the way when it comes to official acknowledgement of the true manner of life in the spirit world. That is why the truth is in the hands of unofficial folk. You see what a lecture your simple proposition has brought upon you.
Ruth suggested that we sit down for a while. We found a spot beneath a tree upon slightly rising ground, where we could see in the distance a glittering expanse of water.
Doesn't it seem an awful pity, Roger, said Ruth, that so many millions of people on earth should know nothing about this lovely land? And doesn't it seem outrageous that officially they should be warned off from knowing anything, and for the most silly, stupid reasons?
What harm, what possible harm could there be in knowing all about us and the life we live? One would think we are absolute outcasts, or peculiar people it was better not to have anything to do with.
It makes me furious. Now, don't you get overheated, my dear, I said. This wholesale ignorance isn't a new thing. It's been going on for hundreds of years. That's the real trouble. It's been going on too long, so that people have got into the one way of thinking, mostly the religious or theological way. You know, Roger, it's not so very surprising that hundreds of people, when they arrive here and find out the truth, go about like a mighty wind, and want to go back to earth to shout the truth at last to the folk they've left behind them. Some of them actually do go back, but the result is dismal on both sides. Their voices cannot be heard, that is, heard in the very place where they want them to be. Take yourself, my boy. Ruth and I could lead you to a little spot on Earth where we could make ourselves known among old friends. We could introduce you to them, and ask if they would convey a message for you to your people at your old home.
Very well. What would happen next?
Remember, your relations would be complete strangers to our friends, and presumably your people know nothing about communication between the two worlds, or if they know, do not believe it can be done. What do you suppose would be the result when our friends presented themselves at your parents' house, and said they had a message from their Roger? You know best what would happen, because you know them.
As a matter of interest, Roger, what would happen?
The boy thought a moment. They would be civil, at least, he said, but a bit grim. Probably think your friends cranks, if not altogether mad. They don't look like cranks, Roger, so they might be able to escape that. But mad, yes, perhaps, though they don't give any evident or unmistakable signs of that either.
What next?
They might think it in shockingly bad taste.
Ah, that would be difficult to overcome.
Bad taste that our friends should intrude upon their bereavement, and so on.
Then what?
I rather fancy your friends would be shown the front door. After that, they would discuss it between themselves, and go off to see their vicar. He would listen civilly, and tell them he had heard about such things, but that they were far better left alone.
That's about it, Roger.
The same old story all over again, and one we have to recount, and keep on recounting, to people as they arrive here in their thousands, and want to go back to Earth to speak. The chief trouble with the churches is that they cannot make the truth about this world fit in with their theology. They don't realize that they are going about things the wrong way. They must make their theology fit the truth, and that means a wholesale clearance of everything that does not accord with it. At present they prefer the shadow to the substance, they prefer creeds and doctrines and dogmas. They are not realists, far from it. Let us put the matter plainly, even crudely, if you wish it. Here are three of us, human beings who once lived on Earth. We have passed through the experience of dying, and now we are seated in the spirit world upon some delightfully soft turf beneath a beautiful tree, with all the lovely countryside round about us, and reaching for miles away into the distance. It is all unquestionably real and solid. It is no spiritual experience in the religious sense, but an everyday experience of a very ordinary nature. We are here, all three of us, because, by virtue of man's spiritual heritage, it is our right to be here, and not because of what we believed on Earth, or through the merits of any particular church to which we belonged. Ruth will tell you herself that she gave up going to church altogether. Yet she is here with us, and she will tell you she was an awful heathen in the eyes of her church. Another church would call her a heretic and a schismatic, and doomed to who knows what terrible place for her sins. As for myself, I was a priest of the church, and should have known better but didn't.
You, Roger, are young, but I believe you did not become exactly a pillar of your church.
Now between us, and strictly from the theological point of view, you two should not be here at all, if this place is reserved for folk like me. If my theology, and all the doctrines and dogmas I rigorously upheld and preached about, have brought me to this particular region of the spirit world, then you two have no business to be here at all. You can't say, theologically speaking, that either of you is the least fitted to be in my company, for you, Ruth, on your own terrible confession, were no churchgoer all latterly in your earth life, and you, Roger, were only half-hearted in it. It's extremely difficult for me to adjudicate between you, and settle who is the worse sinner. You are both pretty bad, it would seem, and I have no business to be in your company, or you have no business to be in mine. But the stubborn fact is that you are here, and so am I.
What is the conclusion?
There's only one, that something is wrong somewhere with all the theology. The theology doesn't fit the facts. Let us go further. When you were on Earth, Roger, did you go about your daily life in a pious frame of mind? It sounds a silly question to ask, but did you?
No, Monsignor, I certainly did not.
Of course, you didn't. No rationally constituted person does. One may have pleasant thoughts, kindly thoughts, and do pleasant, kindly actions, but that is not going about and behaving in a pious manner, and generally being sanctimonious and altogether objectionable. Now, How do you feel about things at this present moment? Any different? Not a particle. And so, if a bulletin were issued, it might read like this: no change has been reported in Roger's condition other than his now feeling perfectly fit in bodily health. He is in the most cheerful spirits, as well as being with them, and is at this moment thoroughly enjoying himself if his face is any indication of the state of his mind. He is pleased to inform all theologians that he does not feel the least particle pious or holy, and is most thankful that he feels himself, and nobody else. Would you subscribe to that declaration, my lad?
I would, indeed, Monsignor. I wouldn't swap this back for the old earth.
Exchange, Roger, exchange. You must understand that swap is a word that would never be used by a disembodied entity, that you would be expected to speak the most perfect language, entirely free from all slang and vulgarisms, and that everything you say must be profound in nature and weighty in substance. That's how we are expected to behave by most of the Earth people, the uninstructed ones. Now the great point is that there are no evident signs of piety or holiness, or even of religiosity to be seen here, nor do we go about quoting in scripture or other uplifting texts to one another, and behaving in a thoroughly unnatural manner. In brief, we are not living in a religious institution or a religious world as a whole, but in a sane, sensible world, of incomparable beauty, where we can work and play, as we wish, and laugh to our heart's content. And where, moreover, and this is vitally important, where we can be ourselves, and not be as others on earth would mistakenly have us to be. Isn't it odd that when I had plenty of pulpits at my disposal to preach from, I had nothing much to say as I see it now? And now I have a great deal to say, I have no pulpit.
5. Spirit locomotion. We had been walking along in leisurely fashion when Roger turned to me.
Is walking the only means of getting about? He asked.
I can't see any roads anywhere, and the countryside seems to stretch for miles.
It does stretch for miles, I replied, thousands of them.
What you mean, Roger, is, where's the transport system and what is it?
The answer is that we each of us carry our own transport system about with us, the most efficient and the most rapid in the universe. That is in addition to walking. So far we have relied upon our 2 legs since we brought you here, but the time has obviously come when we must show you something of what we can really do here. Personal locomotion is done by the thought process, and it's perfectly easy to do when once you are shown how, then it becomes second nature. It may sound like a contradiction in terms, but the thought process of locomotion hardly requires thinking about when once you are accustomed to.
Can you remember when you first learned to walk on Earth, Roger?
No, I can't say I do. I don't suppose there are many who can. But there did come a time when you could keep upright successfully and without tumbling down. Since then you have walked many miles on Earth, and some distance here as well. Do you ever think about it? Suppose you are sitting in a chair and you wish to rise and cross the room, you simply rise and walk without thinking of all the muscles that have to be controlled to get your limbs on the move. You do all that without thinking, though there must be some thought somewhere, obviously, or else you would remain rooted where you were. What particular line does the thought take, that you must walk, or that you wish to rise, or that you want to cross the room, or all three? It doesn't matter. Basically, the desire is to get across the room. The other side of the room is your destination. And that's all you need to consider here in using the thought process to move yourself about. At first, you must make a really conscious effort, you must think about it. A little practice, and you will find that no sooner do you think, than you are wherever you wish to be.
Sounds rather fantastic, don't you think?
It does a bit. It's the sort of thing skeptical folk on Earth like to poke fun at, and generally ridicule. Such a splendid joke and causes roars of laughter. The same folk should take out their Bibles and study them a little more, and then bring their wits to bear upon what they read there. A great many of our ways here form a constant source for derision among the incarnate, Roger. Taking the Earth as the standard for everything, including life itself, they cannot imagine anything better or different. Of course, they'll regard heaven as a place or condition of perfection, but of perfection of what, they know not, and cannot imagine.
I would say seriously to such people not to pour scorn upon our spirit lands and the way we do things unless they are prepared to provide better. If there is any single feature or factor or law to which they take exception, let them at once suggest a better or finer or more sensible, and all of us here in the spirit world will gladly listen, and see that their suggestions reach the right quarter. We need not, of course, worry ourselves unduly about these folk. If there is anything of which they disapprove when they come here, they are at liberty to depart, to remove themselves, leaving us in the enjoyment of our own mode of life, while they betake themselves elsewhere and create their own bleak void and live in it. My two companions had such a merry twinkle in their eyes, that I subsided into laughter. "You know, Roger," said Ruth, "Monsignor feels very strongly on some subjects. He caught the public eye and ear when he was a priest, and since coming here he has done the same thing again in a very different way. He knows how hard it is to get people to shake off old and wrong beliefs for the truth, and it really vexes him. That is perhaps one of the penalties, if one can call it so, for being in such close touch with the earth. I'm not, though I visit it occasionally with Monsignor purely to watch proceedings and give a greeting to our friends there. Thoughts are very real, Roger," she continued, "and can reach us here from Earth as easily and as surely as they can reach us here between ourselves. And ours can go to the Earth people too, though they don't always notice them. Perhaps that's what accounts for the feeling I've had. I don't know how to describe it, but there seems to be a sort of pulling, if you follow, a kind of urge to go well I don't know where. Oh, this is all terribly vague. I've felt peculiar, not ill, but restless, I suppose." "Poor Roger," said Ruth, "I think we can diagnose your complaint without difficulty. The trouble is caused by friends or relations, or both perhaps, sending out a few thoughts of grief. It's natural they should be sorry you've left them, though their sorrow is not deep, or else you would have felt it very keenly yourself, and that would have been troublesome. I doubt if this feeling will get stronger, but if it should, tell us, Roger, and we'll help to dispel it. You have no personal regrets yourself on any account?" "None whatever, Ruth, thank you." "Good, that's a great help." We seem to have wandered a trifle from Roger's question. "Do you recall, Ruth, soon after we had arrived here, how we discussed the quaint notion of angelic beings having wings? Strange idea, isn't it, Roger? The only thing one can imagine is that long ago, people, especially artists, must have wondered how angelic beings managed to get about. Legs would seem preposterous, out of the question, by being far too mundane. I mean for perambulating purposes. But if one eliminates the use of legs, what remains? Nothing, so far as I can see, and I suppose that is how it struck the artists. Angels must be able to move, they can't be rooted to one spot for all eternity. That, one supposes, led some genius to invent huge wings for all inhabitants of the spirit world. I believe Satan himself was endowed with a pair, as, of course, it was essential for him to be extremely mobile so that he could get about comfortably and quickly seeking the ruin of souls, as one pretty prayer expresses it. Can you think of anything more clumsy and ponderous than having an enormous pair of wings fastened upon you somewhere in the region of the shoulder blades? I can't, I should imagine," said Roger, "that a large flock of angels would stir up an awful breeze when in flight." "Roger, I'm afraid you are being highly irreverent in referring to a large number of angels as a flock. Well, what would they be, then?" "I really don't know, it's not easy to find a word for what doesn't exist, except poetically, perhaps. But you are severely practical when you say that a great concourse that is more elegant than flock, Roger, would disturb the atmospheric conditions, and that's something the artist fellows never thought of. It is astonishing how the idea originally caught on and has persisted even to the present day. The conventional way of portraying a being from this world and they still don't look upon us as human, only half human is with two large wings. Even symbolically it's a pretty poor idea. As a means of personal locomotion, wings would be useless, an impossibility, and we should be anatomical monstrosities. We're obviously not built for such apparatus, the wonders and marvels of the spirit world notwithstanding.